Welcome to Embracing the Muse. I'm your host, Sally Jean Fox, the author of Meeting the Muse After Midlife. And I'm on a quest to discover and understand how we can live our richest, most meaningful, and creative lives at any age, and especially as we age. And I'll be interviewing island creatives to discover what they can share with us about the highs and lows, ups and downs, and possibilities of living and sustaining a creative life. I am delighted today to have an opportunity to interview the film documentarian John DeGraff. I've heard about John for years and know that he has been uber productive for decades. But I didn't actually get to see one of his works until he came to the Vashon Library, actually last Sunday, to answer questions about his wonderful film, From Sea to Shining Sea. The film explores the rich life of poet, professor, and social reformer Catherine Lee Bates, author of America the Beautiful. I have to admit, I knew nothing about Catherine Lee Bates, and I ended up being fascinated by her. What an incredibly interesting choice of subject. And I highly recommend the film. You can stream it off of Bullfrog Films or ask your local library to get a copy because it's also being distributed that way. And unlike some historical documentaries, which I might consider to be a bit dusty, this one was very timely and also very beautiful. You know, America the Beautiful had a lot of beauty and art in it, and my husband and I thoroughly enjoyed it. So I'm so happy to be able to interview you, John, after seeing the film, so we can also talk about your work.
Sure, my pleasure.
Yeah. Now, your career goes way back, way back. And I also think it's fun because partly of what I'm doing on the show is looking at what it takes to live a creative life over time. Because it's one thing to be creative in the moment, but then there's another thing to be able to sustain 4 or 5 decades of creative work as you have. So take me back. Were you always interested in becoming a film director, producer, or?
No. No, that happened completely by accident, frankly. I was never trained in it. I had no classes in film or anything like that. I first thought that I would be a national park ranger. I mean, I grew up basically in the Bay, San Francisco Bay Area, and was crazy about Yosemite and the Sierra Mountains. Spent a lot of time there backpacking as a kid, and fell in love with the mountains and thought that I would be eventually a national park ranger. But it turned out that college and I didn't get along particularly well at first, and I went in a different direction. I started studying sociology, and then eventually dropped out of school completely. I worked as a community organizer, did various things of that sort, and finally got into radio, working for the public radio station at the University of Minnesota in Duluth, Minnesota, where I ended up meeting an old guy, that time 85 years old, a Corsican immigrant to the United States, who had never gone past the sixth grade, but ended up being a U.S. congressman and distinguished himself in Congress. He was a fascinating guy at 85 when I met him in 1977. And I thought somebody should do a film about him.
And
His name was Johnny Bernard.
Okay.
And he was, you know, a French background, a Corsican, probably partly Italian background as well. And it turned out that that film, which we gave when we made it, my colleague and I gave it to Minnesota Public Television, and they aired it, and unknown to us, they submitted it to National Public Television for its annual local programming awards. And lo and behold, we got the grand prize. And so it was quite a shock because we had no idea even that they were doing it, but it kind of gave me this thing called a track record. I don't think the film was deserving of that, but I think what I did right was pick a good character. And maybe the Bates thing comes from that, because people fell in love with my subject, even though our filmmaking was pretty amateurish at that time.
Yeah, how old were you when you first made that film?
30.
30. Wow. Wow.
And then it took me 4 years to get into filmmaking full time. I had to work part-time jobs until that point. But then in 1982, I started doing documentary full time, starting at Channel 9 in Seattle as an independent house independent, and started making films with Channel 9 at that time. One of them about Bainbridge Island, one of them, well, several related to local subjects, but also national subjects. And after that, some years after that, I had a chance to work with your brother David and his wife Diana Wilmar, and have worked with them for many, many years on quite a number of projects. They're both terrific camera people and editors, so it's been a great experience.
Yeah, well, they think the world of you. And I was talking to David just a few minutes ago, and I said, "Are there any special questions for John?" And he didn't really have any. He talked about your mountaineering experience and how you had gone out, and I don't know if this was the right site, but you'd been out on your own for 30 days in the wilderness at one point, and he remembers your story about that.
Well, not on my own. I was with one other, with a friend. We were high school kids at the time, though, and it was
But
about
30 days in
three.
the wilderness as a high school kid is a long time.
Well, it was about 6 weeks. It was actually longer than
Oh my
that,
gosh.
but we came into town every week or so to buy supplies, and then we went back into the wilderness. So we weren't in solid. We didn't carry 30 days worth of supplies. So we'd do a week, and then we'd walk out from some place in the Sierra Nevada mountains to a road end, hitchhike to the nearest town, go to the supermarket and resupply our food, hitchhike to another road end, and go in again for another week into another part of the Sierra Nevada wilderness. And we did
Wow.
that. We did 2 6-week trips like that, one after my sophomore year in high school and one after my senior year. And so we were 15 and 17 years old at the time, no parents, had a wonderful time. It was, I think, a time when parents were a little more willing to let kids do things like that. And I'm eternally glad that mine were.
Well, that sounds like it could have been movie material. It's making me think of Cheryl Strayed's Wild, where she hiked the Pacific Crest Trail and stuff. But I'm glad that yours worked out so well. It would suggest, and tell me if I'm right on this, that you carry a love of nature and the environment. And has that been a theme in your filmmaking as well?
Yeah, it certainly has. I'm certain not all my films, but I have done quite a number of environmental films, and I think more known as an environmental filmmaker than anything else. I did have a chance to go back to Yosemite, oh, about 15 years ago with David and Diana to work on a film there. We backpacked in the backcountry in Yosemite and worked on a film called The Great Vacation Squeeze
Oh, I heard
about
about that. Yeah.
how Americans get so little vacation time in comparison to people in other countries. And we interviewed a marvelous ranger, Shelton Johnson, in Yosemite National Park, who is just an absolutely amazing guy. I just heard from him the other day. He's a photographer himself, and I think we had a great time. We just were out backpacking for several days and carried all our stuff. We had some help with a couple of other people carrying gear, including David and Diana's son Simon and my son David. So those are just some of the experiences. That's just one of the experiences that I had with David and Diana.
Yeah, and so the film that was documenting how Americans are losing vacation and not really taking much at all, in contrast to the Europeans, you founded a whole movement called Take Back Your Time. Which came first, the movement or the film?
Oh, the movement for sure. The film didn't come out until 2014, no, 2012, something like that. Anyway, but the movement started in 2002, and it was just coming to an end about the time that the film was made.
And what was the movement? Tell us the short form of
Well,
what.
take back your time. What we were arguing as a campaign was, again, that Americans were overworked compared to people in other countries, particularly European countries, so that we were really the only rich nation in the world that didn't have paid maternity leave, family leave, sick leave, and vacation time, paid vacation time. And we campaigned for those things. We even were able to get a bill into the US Congress for vacation time, a vacation bill, but it got nowhere. But anyway, we did get some Congress people to support that. We were able to be somewhat successful, not alone, but with help of other groups in getting, for instance, a paid family leave bill passed here in Washington State, and eventually paid sick leave. But again, that wasn't just us. There were a lot of groups working on that.
It's an interesting topic, and a really important one, but it's also a little ironic because I would bet that you are very busy in order to be able to be as productive and have the kind of track record you did. Don't you stay pretty busy?
Well, it is one of my failings. You know how people say, "Do as I say, not as I do." I
Yeah.
did start another organization. Didn't go very far, but it's called AHA, the American Hypocrites Association, and that's for people who work very hard, encouraging people not to work so hard.
Yeah, that's good. Well,
That would be
I could see a broader application of that, especially as people nominate each other for their membership in that organization.
Award, yeah.
You could have a special category for gaslighting, but that's a different category altogether, you know. So when you look at yourself and your career, are you I mean, this is kind of an unfair question, but do you see yourself as social activist first or documentary film producer and or speaker writer?
Well, it's all sort of blends together. I mean, I started out as a social activist. An anti-war activist, an anti-Vietnam War, an activist for social justice issues. That led me into filmmaking. And really, for about 20 years, I did nothing but filmmaking. All of my activism was filmmaking. It wasn't really until I made a film called Affluenza in the late 1990s, which was my most popular film, and then started Take Back Your Time as an organization, that I really got back into the activism. And it was activism about overconsuming, about materialism, and then about overwork, those two issues. So that brought me back into activism. And then as a result of that work, I really started getting invited to do a lot of public speaking, particularly at colleges and universities. And that included other countries. And then I got interested in about 2010 in this kind of worldwide happiness movement that was going on with countries like, especially the little country of Bhutan between China and India in Asia, which talked about gross national happiness instead of gross national product. And I got very interested in what they were doing and in happiness, and I got asked to do some speaking around the issue of time, around overwork and its impact on happiness. And I spoke several countries around the world, and then was invited to Bhutan as an advisor to the government there on a whole thing they were submitting to the United Nations as a so-called expert on work-life balance, which is sort of funny. You don't have
Yeah, now that we're talking, yeah.
But I didn't know the facts about, what different countries have and what the laws are around the world and what people generally get. And I had become something of an expert in that. So I think that I worked a bit with the International Labour Organization in Geneva on those issues. And I became fairly versed on who had what and how much of it. And so they brought me to Bhutan, and I had a great time meeting the entire cabinet, the prime minister, even the king and queen. But spent again, my whole time there was working. I didn't even get to get out and see
Oh
any of the
dear.
beautiful country. I was in a parliament building, basically
Yeah.
one of the
No extra happiness breaks for you guys, you know.
time. And Bhutan is this little poor country. But soon afterwards, I was invited to a very rich country, the United Arab Emirates, to the glitzy city of Dubai, to give some lectures on happiness there. and time and the issues. So it was interesting to discover that there are only two countries in the world that have a ministry of happiness, Bhutan and the United Arab Emirates. These two countries could not be more different. I mean, it's absolutely different. I preferred Bhutan, frankly. I much enjoyed preferred my time in Bhutan. Dubai was just much too materialistic for my tastes,
Yeah,
but
it's
it
a
was
little
all
over the top.
interesting.
And also Dubai, if I understand, because I've only gone through the airport, it's pretty stratified that happiness if you're a Filipino refugee in Dubai is going to look like different than happiness if if you were born into Dubai and are Arab.
Well, I think that that's absolutely true. Although, of course, when you talk to some of the folks there, there is some relative stuff involved in that. Many of those guest workers, while their conditions are not great, and I'll be the first to agree with that, will tell you how much better they are than what they had at home,
Well, there you go.
because of the
Yeah.
poor countries that they were coming from. So
Yeah.
the world is th this is the problem. The world is so divided now between people who are so fabulously rich and people who are so very poor, that there are all these different differentials and such. And so I think Dubai is really measuring the happiness of the Emiratis who live there, that
Yeah. Yeah.
15% of the population who run things. In Bhutan, it measures everybody.
Yeah, it's such a great topic. I am curious. Last year at this time, I was interviewing Phil Grabsky, who is an independent filmmaker out of England. He's won a BAFTA award, and we were talking about the state of independent film production from his perspective. And it was hard. It's a hard industry. So you've seen it for 40 plus years. What's it like to be an independent film producer, and how has the industry changed in the time that you've been a part of it?
Well, the biggest changes have come very recently with all of the streaming and all of this, and also with the ease of access to very good equipment. For instance, you can buy a phone now, or a small camera or something for $1,000 or $2,000 and take much better pictures than you could with a $50,000 top of the line camera when I started out, or even for quite a few years thereafter. So it has changed in that it's much more accessible now to everybody. So now suddenly everybody has become a filmmaker. And that makes it a little more, or a digital creator. In fact, if you look at Facebook now, you'll just see how many people call themselves digital creators, that's their identification. What that means, I have no clue. But the fact is that that's both, there's a good side and a bad side. The bad side is that there's literally so much competition for a very small amount of resources to make films. The good side is that many more people get to try their hand in this, and so more of them come out being good, than we had before,
Yeah,
because the pool is much, much bigger. So the
it's
quality of work, I think, particularly from a technical standpoint, the quality of work has definitely improved. Now, from a storytelling standpoint, I would question that.
yeah. Well, and it's also, as an independent author, the it was quite an opportunity to be able to take charge of my own book and get it out into the world. On the other hand, the economics of that, which is the side of being an independent creator, you can get it out as long as you foot the bill, because there are fewer, in the publishing world, it's, fewer and a more monopolistic publishing industry. I wonder if something is parallel in the film production that there are, I don't know if there are as many grants and opportunities to get your work out as there were before.
Well, I think there are more opportunities that reach a much smaller segment of the population, and many fewer opportunities to reach a larger segment of the population. So it's much, much harder now, for instance, than it was to get a film on PBS. And I've had about 20 films nationally on PBS, including several that I worked on with your brother and Diana. But it's harder now. There's no question about that because there's simply so many films being produced at this time. Publishing, I guess it is similar to publishing. I mean, I've also written books, and I had one international bestseller, which was a very nice thing to have. That was Affluenza, which started as a film and then became a very successful book as well. But my later books didn't do nearly so well. And I think it's harder and harder now. And so when you look at it, the average book only sells about 2,000 copies over its lifetime, maybe about 250 copies per year. And some obviously that's kind of average or median book, so you know that some of them are doing a lot less than that. And about
Right.
80% of the books are now self-published. So it's all a whole different ball game than it was when I started out in film and in writing.
So, what would you say to somebody who is up and coming in the independent film world, like my nephew, who, at the early stage of their career? What kind of advice would you give to them?
Well, these days, which I would not have done necessarily when I was starting, because it doesn't describe me. I never went to school for film or anything like that. But I certainly would not discourage that at this point in time, because I think going and getting some training in film at a university or college gives you a lot of access to equipment, gets you some knowledge about contacts and who to associate with and so forth. So I think that can be very valuable. I think that some of my I teach not low, recently, but I have taught a lot of classes in documentary film, and one of the things I say to people is that you've probably seen those bumper stickers. You don't see them so often anymore, but you used to see these bumper stickers everywhere that said, "Think globally, act locally," and I think that's good advice because. Really, so many people want to make the big film their first time out. They want to make the big film about something going on somewhere in Africa or whatever. And, it's cost a mint to do it. And I say, no, really sort of start with something local that is easy for you to access. But then think of a subject that not only is a local story, but has wider implications. So it would have interest to people who are not just local. And I think that's what I did the first films that I made. And I was therefore able to do them on small budgets but get a wider impact. As you get better and as you get more well known with your films, then you can expand. And so it really wasn't until I would say I had been doing films for 10, 15 years before I was able to really do sort of national subjects and then eventually international subjects as well.
Well, one of the things that I loved going back to from Sea to Shining Sea was that you were taking a particular slice of history, and it wasn't a big slice of history. You were introducing us to a character that if you didn't go to Wellesley College, you might not have known, or you heard of in passing. But it was so interesting because it's like that adage that in the particular lies the universal. And listening to the story of this one individual who penned America the Beautiful, I felt like the world of American history was opening up to me and that it was timely and relevant at the same time. So, in that sliver of history, you really packed a lot in.
Well, thanks. I certainly was trying to do that. I always believe that, as human beings, what matters is how we respond to the world we're given and how we do what we can to make that in some way a better world. And a lot of times I think right now we have a habit of looking at people in the past and who didn't do everything the way we now think is politically correct or, that they were somehow less than. Whatever. I mean, I think we have the progressive side of the fence, which I am. I'm certainly a person of the left, but I think we've far too often canceled figures from history simply because they didn't see the world and we're not in a world that we're in, and we're pressured by many other kinds of things in terms of how they view the world. But they advanced the cause of humanity in some way. That was the point, that they saw that world and tried to make it a better world, more expansive, more diverse, more just and more inclusive. And that's what's important, the overall impact that a person had on their culture, not every little thing they might have said and done in the course of their lifetime. That's one thing that's really dawned on me, is that if the number of people that, if you just go and pick out some quotes from something they said when they were young or this or that, it's very easy to kind of destroy them. But if you really look at their full life and what they did in the context of history, then you can really see what good and important people they were and what a difference they made. So I've tried in my work to tell these stories of these individuals who I think made a positive difference for our society. And I always felt that I can't do that without showing people the real life of the time, what they were confronted with,
And that
what
was,
they saw.
yeah, in that film, it was so powerful because, it wasn't that long ago, but seeing pictures of the immigrant life in New York City, for example, I've seen some of those pictures before, but it was horrendous. It really, in just a few black and white pictures, you got a whole slice into the immigrant experience. And then the part that you did on the Spanish American War. I mean, I did my history. I was a smart kid, but I know basically nothing about the Spanish American War. And I didn't know how brutal it was and how cruel and what the body count was and how imperialistic and how awful it was. I hadn't really no clue. They didn't teach me about that.
Yeah, no, I think that we unfortunately don't learn very much about that. And one of the people in film, Steve Kinzer, a historian and former New York Times reporter, talks about how 1898, what a big change that was for this country. When we entered the Spanish-American War in order to take Spanish colonies for ourselves, Cuba, the Philippines, Puerto Rico, etc. We were changing from a nation that was a former colony, and that believed that it should not be an imperial power, in fact, opposed imperial, to one that wanted to become an imperial power and take other colonies. And it was that that Catherine Lee Bates was so opposed to and fought against, spoke against, wrote against, and included in certainly one of the verses of America the Beautiful, a condemnation of the Spanish-American War in metaphor, in the terms of America, America, God mend thine every flaw, confirm thy soul in self-control. This was really about, we shouldn't be going all over trying to take other countries. And the irony is that this came under the President McKinley, who is the president that our current president likes best, along with Andrew Jackson, who was really, in a way, another imperialist, but more toward American Indians. And at his inauguration, President Trump, like most presidents do, played America the Beautiful. He even performed a little dance to the music and so forth, showing how limber and hip he was. And then immediately followed that by talking about how he was going to change the name of Mount Denali, the Indian name of the mountain in Alaska, back to Mount McKinley, and how McKinley was kind of a hero of his, and how he was going to, in a way, follow in McKinley's footsteps by, if he could, taking over Canada, Greenland, and Panama. Well,
Yeah.
this is amazing that the same president who's there playing America the Beautiful is talking in such terms about the president that the author of America the Beautiful despised most. And how ironical can you get?
Yeah. And again, what I loved in the film, because I think it's so important, is sort of the mix of all is not any one thing. Here you have this song that we sing because it's sweet and it's uplifting and it has these gorgeous images in it. We don't sing all the verses, though, where she referred to things that were far more difficult in her metaphoric way. And that in her own life, she was both able to take in the majesty and the horror of what was happening. And they were both there. And for me, that was what I found in a certain way uplifting about the film, because it's so easy to kind of get get horrified by what's happening today and feel despondent and feel like, how could this possibly be happening? So to have that balance where we can have both the awe for the magnificence, the quest for goodness, and at the same time the outrage.
Yeah, well, I believe that she did see a lot of progress in her lifetime, but she also saw a lot of pain and a lot of things that did not set well with her at all. And, she tried to handle those things as best she could. This is an example of that. There was a big strike in 1912 called the Bread and Roses Strike in Lawrence, Massachusetts, where all these textile workers, most of them immigrant women, walked out of the textile plants for better wages. Now, other professors from Wellesley, where she taught, went to Lawrence, which was only 40 miles away, joined the picket line, spoke for the strikers. That effort actually caused a lot of wealthy donors to desert Wellesley. And so Kathleen Bates was caught in the middle. She had to say she was totally sympathetic with the strikers, but she was really afraid of what was that her college was going to collapse because suddenly the money was being cut off, and she had to negotiate that. And the trustees wanted her to fire professor who'd gone up to one of the professors who'd gone up there. And she didn't want to do that because she personally believed in what that person was doing. But they had to compromise. They finally did. I mean, the woman who ended up having to write an apology to the trustees, not saying that she was sorry because she supported the strikers, but that she was sorry that she had put the funding of the college at risk.
I thought it was an absolutely elegant solution. And part of my life, I've been both a university administrator and a university professor, and so I know those places of being in between where you can, where you feel like you can't quite afford to be noble and pure, because you're also trying to hold the well-being of your single moms who have come to school and really deserve to be able to finish their education, and you want things to go on for them. And you also are sympathetic to the cause, but you can see you when you're right in the middle of it, it's complex. And
Sure.
like you said, when you reduce life to sound bites, it's never that complex. And I wish we could all develop a little capacity to hold complexity, you know?
Yeah, well, we try to do that with a film, and I hope
I
that
think you
we
succeeded. I
continue
love it.
to
And I,
work.
again, I'm interviewing John DeGraff about, and I recently saw his film From Sea to Shining Sea, about the author of America the Beautiful, and I totally recommend it. So what's next? You began to tell me you have another project in the wings, which you're kind of at an age where you could rest on your laurels, John, you know?
Well, I'm just starting on my fourth last film. So,
Okay. Yeah, David said you're frequently saying it's your last, but you
my
never come
last
through.
film, but I think this one will be because I'm getting a
Oh, okay.
little, it's getting a little harder for me to do these things. But
Yeah.
this film is a story, another biography, but in this case, it's a story about an economist. It's called Econoclast, Herman Daly and the Gospel of Growth. And Herman Daly was one of the very first economists, US economists, who really questioned the whole value of economic growth, which our society is obsessed with. Whether you're Republican or Democrat in this society, you're always talking about I can grow the economy 4%, you can only grow the economy 3%, all this kind of stuff. And what Daly showed is that this doesn't indicate how well we're doing, and that in many cases, economic growth is making us poorer. It's creating many other social problems, causing environmental problems, and it doesn't solve those problems. To some degree, it can alleviate some of them, but in other ways, it makes them worse. And it's making it so that we are running out of resources, that we are polluting the planet to a serious way, most notably with climate change, of course, but in many other ways as well. And we really have to ask ourselves, can't we find a way to live within the Earth's resources and boundaries and create a steady state economy in which we don't grow richer materially, but we do be develop better in terms of our intelligence, our social interaction, our experience of nature, and those kind of things. So this is what Daly preached. He went all the way. He was even hired at one point for 6 years to the World Bank to promote many policies, which were good policies. He there it's very timely in a sense that his biggest opponent at the World Bank was a guy who's just been in the news a lot in the last few days, Larry Summers, in connection with the Epstein files. But this, of course, wasn't about that. But Larry Summers is always a great advocate of economic growth and traditional economic values, and Herman Daly was not. So I think Daly's ideas have a lot of resonance, especially in Europe, where they're very, very popular. And I hope that with this film, we'll get more of them out for people here, and they will see the necessity to turn this around. We don't have to keep having more and more wealth, and or it's not making us happier, and it's really threatening the planet. So we got to find some alternative. Doesn't mean we can't grow, because obviously some poor countries do need to grow and just to meet basic needs. But for that to happen, a lot of us in the richer nations have to curb our, not our enthusiasm, but our consumption,
Yeah.
and increase our enthusiasm for living more simply.
I love it. When can we expect to see it?
Well, that's always the big if. Funding is a real issue here. My hope is that it would be done about this time next year, so
Great, great.
about a year. We'll probably have versions of it along the way, and we haven't even decided yet how long it will be, but it is underway, and we do have a sample video that I can send you a link to. It's just 6 minutes,
I would like to
which
see that. That'd be
would be
cool.
wonderful for you to share that. And so we're moving forward. I'm playing the AHA role, American Hypocrites Association role, well, and I can
So,
keep it
John,
up.
you're a master storyteller. What's the story about John DeGraff moving into his 80s and beyond?
I'm still above ground.
I think you can do better than that.
Well,
No, what, really,
I
'cause
feel lucky
you've
about
been
that.
so engaged as a filmmaker, and also, a very physical occupation that doesn't really ride well into towards the 90s, but our souls still need to be fed even as we age. So what's gonna be filling you?
Well, I've always been interested in the whole subject of beauty, what I call the politics of beauty, because I think beauty, and this means the beauty of nature, particularly protecting nature, but also the beauty of cities. And I like the intimate cities, or the city, small cities of Europe, or cities where we're at an intimate scale, which is the places that people enjoy visiting most. People go to Venice and Florence and Rome and all these places for a reason. Because that architecture appeals, it feels comfortable, it feels humane, and nature. So I've argued that whether you're conservative or a liberal, you probably like your garden, or you like flowers, and you like national parks, because you can see when you visit there that people of every stripe and every race and color and way of thinking love those national parks. And so I believe that a campaign around beautifying America, making America even more beautiful, and certainly sparing its beauty, and sparing nature, so that our children will have that, is a way that we can both bring people together and improve life in this culture and around. Now, it is true that when I give speeches on that subject, which I do, they are far more popular in Europe than they are here. So we're just a little behind the curve, I'm afraid.
Yeah, because I think I read an article, I think, on your website about beauty, and just thinking that over there they understand the correlation between access to beauty and happiness.
And there is a big correlation which we don't understand. One of the things I argued in a speech, in a couple of speeches in Luxembourg and in Paris last year, was that when we figure out these indices about how about well-being in general, how well is the country doing and stuff. We really need to add beauty as one of the categories that we look at, because studies show in the UK and in other places that when people live in an environment, a city, a location that they consider beautiful or somewhat beautiful, they tend to score about 20 points out of 100 higher than, in general, than people who live in a place that they consider ugly or somewhat ugly or not attractive. So that's a big difference. When you look at it, that's similar to having a lot of friends or having good health or things like that. So beauty really matters, and it is something that we can come together as a nation and work on. So I made a film called Stuart Udall, The Politics of Beauty, about the Interior Secretary of the Kennedy and Johnson years. And he really believed that. He really believed that beauty was a thing that could that we needed to work on and to build on, and that it could bring the country together. And I think he's still right.
And what a great legacy. And the other thing about beauty that affects me personally is, as we age, we may face certain limitations, not be able to get around as much, not travel the way we used to. But if
That's
we,
me.
but when we grow our appreciation for the beauty of the world, that can keep expanding. We can do it from our home front. We can do it from our garden. We can do it anywhere. And so it seemed to me like, why don't we teach each other to increase that appreciation, to be beauty focused, because that's a wave we can ride for the rest of our lives.
Yeah, I fully agree, and I think we need to appreciate some beauty beyond putting a lot of gold stuff in the White House and
Oh
so forth.
God.
And,
No, 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 no,
you
no, no. Yeah, we
know,
won't even go there.
I
No,
think
that's.
we need an assumption of beauty that's about a little bit more unnatural
Well, you
than
know
any
beauty,
kind of beauty.
the beauty that speaks to your heart, the beauty that speaks to your soul, the beauty that makes you pause, the beauty that opens your eyes to the world. That's a beauty, not the beauty that you consume. Yeah. Well,
And
yeah.
that's a message that I share with you.
Yeah. Thank you so much for taking time out of I know your incredibly busy life. And also thank you for the enormous contribution you've made. I was really awestruck going through all of the movements that you've been a part of, the documentaries that you've made, the talks, the books and all. It's really a life of contribution, and I just, it's nice to be able to say thank you.
Well, thank you. I truly appreciate that. It's all been fun, and I've been blessed to have a life that's allowed me both to have a lot of enjoyment, meet a lot of wonderful people, and also hopefully make that kind of contribution.
Yeah, well, John DeGraff, my brother's been talking about you for years, along with Diana, so it's really been a highlight to be able to talk to you myself.
Well, thank you very much. And your brother and Diana are two of my absolute favorite people. So,
Sweet.
okay, thanks much.
Thanks so much for listening. I look forward to being back soon and bringing you another conversation with an island creative who can show you how it's possible to embrace your muse and live your richest and most creative life. Till then, thanks for joining us, and thanks to Voice of Vashon 101.9 FM for hosting this show. I'm your host, Sally Fox, and I look forward to being with you soon.